welcome to Advisor Radio from Horse's Mouth. I'm Sean Bailey, Editor-in-Chief, and today we've got a new segment of Advisor Radio called Coach's Corner. The goal of this feature is to help you and your fellow financial advisors with some of the key challenges of staying focused, goal-oriented, motivated, and energized. I'm happy to have our featured guest, Success Skills Coach Jim Warbach, on the line. Jim describes himself as the personal fitness trainer for your business, and he's helped hundreds of people since opening his coaching business in 1982. Jim is a longtime contributor to Horse's Mouth and has worked with many financial advisors. Happy to have him here today. Jim, welcome, and let's jump right in.
Thanks, Jim, Sean.
We all know how important goal setting is. We've heard it all our lives, starting in grade school with our parents and teachers urging us to reach for the stars. Later, as professionals, these goals get a lot more concrete than saving the world or becoming the next Bill Gates. And by the time someone finds themselves in the business of managing other people's money, there are all sorts of things to measure about ourselves and our business. New clients, new assets, assets under management, portfolio performance, referrals, and a lot more. Now, our first question comes today from Michael M. of Waco, Texas. He's struggling with the question of goal setting. He says, how can I tell if I'm setting my goals too high or too low? I hear about other advisors in my town doing significantly more business than I do, but most of the ones that I know do less than me. Jim, what do you suggest for Michael?
First of all, one has to get clear on one's own sense of mission or purpose about their business. And that's the place where you begin all goal setting. So, for example, when I work with a client, I help them define where do you want to be a year from today in your business and be optimistically realistic. So that means you want to set your goals high but not overwhelmingly high and yet not too low where it's too easy and a piece of cake and you start to get bored with, hey, that was easy, what's next? So then you'd break those yearly goals down into quarterly goals and then monthly goals, and then what do you need to do this week to fulfill those monthly and then quarterly and then annual goals? And it's not a science, it's a little bit of an art, and ideally one works with someone, either a mentor, branch manager, a peer group, or even a coach, to help them define, well, here's where I think I can optimistically, realistically be a year from today.
Mm-hmm. Good. And so, but what about, you know, knowing whether, you know, it's too crazy or it's too easy? How does one get a handle on that?
I think one needs to have some accountability, again, to some entity outside themselves. It could be, again, branch manager, peer group, a mentor, or even a coach that can help them to evaluate, okay, how am I doing? Am I getting the right number of prospects to move forward? Because let's face it, prospecting is the lifeblood of the financial services business. And if you're not out there prospecting, you're not going to bring in a lot of new clients to bring in a lot of new assets. So really, how does one get out there? Is one doing the right things in view of networking with other professionals, asking for referrals, and then improving one's professional selling skills to be engaging in enough new people to bring in the new assets? And only when one gets feedback on these things can one improve their performance.
Right. But now, here's something about it, and I'm sure you've run into this before too, and that is that, you know, there are a decent number of advisors who I'd say are probably, you know, 55 or older. They've still got a long time to go in this business. They've built a successful book of business. Many of them say they're very focused on, you know, servicing their existing clients, and out of that comes a referral or two. So they're not so necessarily focused on growing that, you know, that top line number or the bottom line number for their business. So what about, you mentioned mission and purpose, and what about for, you know, a seasoned advisor who's not, you know, so focused on necessarily, you know, more prospects and more clients?
You know, for seasoned advisors, I would say keep doing what you're doing if you're happy. That it's being successful means knowing what you want, knowing how to get it, and being happy with it. A lot of goals and motivation I don't think applies to senior advisors who are already at a plateau, excuse me, who are already at a plateau and may be pleased with where they're at. This more applies to up-and-coming advisors, maybe ones who haven't been in the game so long or in the game for 10 years, but they're 38, 40, 42, 45, and they're still saying, hey, I have lots of time left in this business. I want to learn, I want to grow, and I want to get better. And maybe they're making, you know, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, $700,000, and they're asking the question, why am I not a million-dollar producer?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're already plateaued, if you're already saying, hey, I'm winding down the business, I don't know if it makes sense for them to set goals or even pay attention to goals. Keep doing what you're doing.
Right, right. But now, you say that your goal setting should be derived from your mission or purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know we've discussed this topic a lot over the years because there does seem to be some confusion about this kind of thing. So why don't, especially now in this first episode of the program, take a minute and discuss you know, what you like to say about mission versus purpose or mission and purpose and how they get confused.
You know, I think you can use those words interchangeably, and I think everyone who is successful has some kind of goal-based mission they're on. Where do you want to be, again, in 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years? And also answer the question, why would that be important to you? Or what would it mean to you if you could do that? And most individuals that go into financial services business have not really looked at that or examined that question, which is why so many go out of business.
Mm-hmm.
Because having any business, whether it's a financial services business or any type of business, is going to be challenging. It's going to test you. It's going to bring you to your knees. It's going to have you up at night asking the question, what was I thinking? And unless you have an answer of the why,
mm-hmm.
why would it be important for me to do this, you're not going to have the staying power.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I suggest anyone have a statement of, as Napoleon Hill calls it in Think and Grow Rich, a statement of chief definite aim or major purpose,
mm-hmm.
which answers the question, here's why I'm in this business.
Mm-hmm.
So to create financial security for my family,
right.
to live in the kind of house I've always dreamed of living in, to have the kind of business where I'm really out there serving and helping people and making the kind of living I want to make. So I can help with ailing elderly parents that may not be self-sufficient themselves,
mm-hmm.
to send my children to the best college, to support the charity or foundation of my choice. Because if you don't have that going in, you're just going to say, well, I'll try this business, and if it doesn't work out, well, hey, I was looking for a job when I started this.
Right. So that statement of definite purpose when people work with you, that is something that you work with them to get absolutely nailed down?
Yes, I have a proprietary mission builder process in which I help people define where they are today and where they want to be a year from today if they've never developed a mission statement before. And the mission statement has goals and a deadline, which is a year from today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the reason that's important is I want them to create that mission statement and then commit it to memory and use it as part of a morning ritual in which they're affirming daily, here's who I am, here's what I'm all about when I cross the white lines of my business. Now, that is prescribed literally in Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich. He literally prescribes people to do that. Many people read the book and go, yeah, yeah, I should write down my statement of chief definite aim or major purpose. Yeah, it sounds like a good idea, and they never do it.
Right.
When they sign up with me, I force them at gunpoint to literally get it done, and then to start a morning ritual of success, which begins with committing it to memory.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where might I have gotten that idea for them to commit it to memory? It's on page 54 of Mike Dorgaard and binding-breaking copy of Think and Grow Rich.
Right.
Any idea, and here is the statement on page 54. Any idea, plan, or purpose may be placed in the mind through repetition of thought. This is why you are asked to write out a statement of your major purpose or definite chief aim, commit it to memory, and repeat it in audible words day after day until these vibrations of sound have reached your subconscious mind. So Napoleon Hill is talking about the concept of auto-suggestion or mental programming in Think and Grow Rich, which was first published in 1937. And if you think about all of the great performers and achievers, either they have already programmed their mind, and this is also in any area of life, if these are great athletes, great business people, great artists, they already in their mind have a vision of, here's what I am going to create. Here's who I am becoming. Right now in my mind, I already am that person.
Right. So for Michael M. of Waco, Texas, then, of course, having a statement of definite purpose would be the overarching thing by which he is backing out his more tactical goals, and you're suggesting, as it relates to his key question about whether he's setting his goals too high or too low, that he have somebody that he work with on that to be able to give him good feedback as to whether it is too crazy or just about right or not enough, I suppose. Is that right?
Yes, and he has to ask himself, if he's been in the business a few years, okay, again, what is optimistically realistic? And then he could do it on his own, create a statement of chief definite aim or major purpose, just by reading Think and Grow Rich, and then getting some feedback, okay, from someone. How is this? And then the person they're getting feedback from, like a coach or a mentor, branch manager, a peer group, would say, okay, if you were to do that, how many new clients at what level would you need to bring in? So does that mean you need to bring in one new $1 million client a month for 12 months? Or does it mean two $500,000 clients per month or 24 new clients? Or four $250,000 clients a month? And is that realistic? Are you going to meet enough people to get in front of that many high net worth people? So those are the kinds of questions that someone who can give them honest feedback can answer that they may not be able to answer for themselves. And that's where they start to judge, maybe bringing in one new $1 million client per month isn't realistic because I'm not in front of enough of those people. However, bringing in two new $250,000 clients a month might be realistic, and there they can set their goal accordingly in their mission for 1 year from today.
Great. All right. Now, Jim, one of the things about the financial advice business that has always fascinated me is the sheer volume of information an advisor must absorb each day. Between the markets, the economy, various asset classes, new product offerings, client problems, prospecting and marketing, the list keeps going. These things are in a nearly constant state of flux. And it's the advisor's job to have a reasonable handle on them, both for their clients and for their own business objectives. It's really an amazing juggling act. Naturally, advisors find this a very hard task. They know in many ways it's nearly impossible to keep up with the ebb and flow of data, information, knowledge, and insights. Even after many years in the business, successful advisors struggle with focus. And focus is the topic of our question from Michael S. of Jacksonville, Texas. Michael says, I've been in the business for over 25 years, and I've always struggled with focus and organization. My strengths are that I am well known in the community and have great relationships with my clients, and I have a real love for people, and I enjoy helping them reach their financial and life goals. But I am easily distracted and have a hard time staying on task. Do you have any suggestions on where and how to start to overcome these obstacles to a more successful and productive business? In other words, can an old dog learn new tricks? So, Jim, Michael's putting it all out there. Can this old dog learn to hunt in new ways?
That's a wonderful description of many advisors' business in terms of being overwhelmed and not being sure about what to be doing. And first of all, I would help this advisor address his self-limiting belief of being an old dog.
Mm.
Or to paraphrase Henry Ford, if you think you're an old dog or you think you're a young dog, you're right. So for all you dog lovers out there, I would suggest that as long as you think you're a young dog, yes, you can learn more.
Mm.
The second thing is that I help my clients to focus on what's truly important. And being a financial advisor is first and foremost a sales and people business. And in my opinion, a financial advisor needs to focus on talking to people. That is their job. Just like Michael Jordan's job wasn't to be selling tickets to Bulls games back in the day. It wasn't to be cleaning the Chicago Stadium. His job was to be playing basketball, to be in the game, on the court, and we all saw how magnificently he did that. So a financial advisor's job is to be interacting with and talking to his clients. He is to be networking with peers and other business owners, and he is to be interacting and conducting consultative interviews with prospects. This is the main purpose of a financial advisor's job. Everything else an experienced financial advisor is doing should be either delegated, subcontracted, or eliminated completely.
Hmm.
Now, I'm not saying one doesn't need to respond to emails, because emails can be overwhelming. At the same time, I teach my clients and coach them on setting boundaries about times to be reactive to email versus being proactive with outbound opportunities to talk to clients, prospects, and networking associates.
Mm-hmm.
A good example is, okay, I'm going to respond to emails between 8 and 9 a.m., then I'm going to be doing my outbound work, then again between 11:30 and 12, then, you know, lunch, maybe a networking lunch, then 1:30 to 2, I'm going to respond to emails. Then 2 to 4 is, again, outbound times where I'm talking to clients and or prospects and or networking with other professionals. Then again, 4:30 to 5, responding to email, so that one doesn't succumb to what's called, one doesn't succumb to what's been called the tyranny of the immediate.
Mm.
Now, why do you think many advisors like to respond to emails and inbound phone calls? And the answer is because emails and inbound calls will never say no. They're always there. They're always going to be there. And if you're to pick up the phone and talk to a client, or especially to a prospect might not want to talk to you. So that fear of rejection kicks in. And you say, gee, why don't I just work on my emails a little longer or work on my newsletter or take these calls rather than do the necessary outbound activity which generates new business.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So for all you old dogs out there, shut off your computer and tell your assistant to let calls either go to either and tell your assistant to either take a message saying that the advisor is not available, would you like to go to voicemail or would you like me to take a message? So you can spend time making your outbound calls to connect with people, which is job one.
Right, right. Yeah, because I think it sounds like, in this case, you know, Michael is, as he says, he's easily distracted. And I imagine he says how he enjoys working with his clients. He really loves people. And you can imagine he places a high value on fast and immediate response. But, of course, you know, getting to somebody within an hour or so is still pretty darn fast in this day and age as well. But I hear what you're saying about trying to, you know, your suggestion that Michael, in essence, find a way to limit the distractions by only opening himself up to receiving the inbound distraction in the first place just for a few times during the day and working on his other priorities the rest of the day.
Yes, and that goes back to the issue of what's your mission or purpose? What are your goals? Where do you want to be a year from today and then a quarter from today and then a month from today? And what's it going to take to get there if your goals are above your current level? And that means you're going to have to commit to setting boundaries on people's access to you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the good news about this is you can retrain your existing clients to wait instead of having an immediate callback, to having a callback in a few hours.
Right.
The truth is that being a financial advisor means you're not in an emergency room in a hospital.
Right.
No one is going to die if they don't get a call back right away and instead get that call back a half day later.
Mm-hmm.
Although some of them think, oh, I've always responded quickly in the past.
Right.
Well, quickly is relative to the need. And again, unless there is some trading deadline emergency, which the people I deal with are not brokers, they're not stock traders.
Yeah, there's not that too many of them left.
Yeah, I understand that if you happen to be a trader and you need to get a trade in before the market closes, well, that's an exception. But again, most of my clients don't do that. But the vast majority, the callback can wait, and that you can't let that distraction take you off of your game of outbound calls, which is really doing a disservice to yourself by taking you away from being in the business of talking to people and marketing and selling your service so you can help the greatest number of people with their financial issues.
Right. Okay, good. So now, Jim, our next question comes from Anthony C. of Findlay, Ohio. It's a very simple question, but it's on a topic that always generates a lot of comment and concern among advisors. It has to do with sales. As you know, many advisors don't like to think of themselves as having to sell. They prefer to view what they do through a lens that doesn't include the word sales. But there's simply no way of getting around the fact that, at a minimum, the process of persuading clients to do business with you or take a certain course of action involves sales. The problem is that there's a lot of underlying emotion going on in any interaction that involves people and their money. So here's Anthony's very short question, Jim. How do you handle emotions in sales? Your thoughts?
First of all, I'm wondering if Anthony means his emotions in sales or his clients' or prospects' emotions in sales. But let's assume that Anthony means it's his own emotion about sales and the selling process.
Mm.
You know, Sean, one of the well-kept secrets, and I don't know why this is a secret, is that when it fights, one of the well-kept secrets is that many people are recruited into the financial services business that get painted a picture that, well, you're going to be doing all these wonderful financial plans for people, help them to create financial security for the future and live happy, successful retirements. And they leave out a small piece that says, and by the way, you have to find these people that have to become your clients.
Right.
So, you know, a lot of the major wirehouses, and I don't mean to cast aspersions, but a lot of major wirehouses recruit people saying, hey, we're going to help you get licensed, and we're going to give you all this great product knowledge, and you're going to have the esteem of being associated with one of the best-known firms in the world. And by the way, don't tell anybody, but you got to, like, sell your service. And this dirty little secret is the death of many, if not most, of the people that go into this business. And let's look at the business of sales. I believe it was Thomas Watson Jr. of IBM who said, nothing happens until there's a sale.
Mm.
In other words, until one person convinces another person to part with resources, usually money, to get either a product or a service. And if that doesn't happen, then nothing happens. If you look at all the great businesses down through the years in America, well, didn't Henry Ford have to convince someone to part with their money for automobiles where there first weren't even many roads to drive on? Didn't Bill Gates have to convince IBM that he had a dirty operating system before he got the money from IBM to create the dirty operating system? And on it goes. So financial advisors have to get comfortable and even embrace the fact that they are in a sales business, and in fact, they need to go out and they do need to interact with people in a way that they induce them to share resources with them in exchange for financial expertise.
Right.
Because let's face it, no one needs a financial advisor. The information is out there online. You can go and get it. And the majority of people that have accumulated wealth are so busy working in their own venue, accumulating the wealth, they don't have the time or energy or even the inclination to study and become experts in their finances. That's why the opportunity for financial advisors exists, to be the expert.
Right.
And it's their job to embrace their role as salespeople. A great book that just came out that I've read recently and even contributed an article to Horse's Mouth on is Dan Pink. He wrote a book. Dan Pink wrote a book called To Sell is Human.
Right.
And then, again, it gets back to the notion that even people who aren't in sales are really spending time convincing, inspiring, motivating others to take action in their best interest. And that is sales at its best.
Right.
To help people to, and if you get good at sales, really the best way to get good at sales is not to try to talk people into using your service as a financial advisor, but it's to use questions in a Socratic method to help people come to their own conclusion about why it's in their best interest
right.
to hire you as their financial advisor. And that's one of the things I coach people on, is don't
right.
present, try to arm twist someone into becoming your client. Use questions who help people become aware of their need for an expert's advice and direction.
Exactly. And now I can't help but also, you know, we're operating on the assumption here that Anthony C. is speaking about handling emotions in the sales process as it relates to himself.
Mm-hmm.
And the one other thing that I think is worth mentioning in this context is the concept of sales shame, which is a real thing. That there have been a number of articles written on that over the years on Horse's Mouth as well, because I would gather that Anthony's saying that he's being held back because of some any variety of underlying emotions that he's having to deal with relating to the sales process. So finding out a little bit more about whether one is suffering from sales shame and how to change it is something worth taking a look at too, I think.
Yes, and it goes back to three questions I like to ask people about their profession or their business. And the first question for Anthony I'd have is, well, Anthony, do you believe you're a good person? And I would assume Anthony would answer yes. The second question, Anthony would have to be honest, is, Anthony, do you believe, and I mean really believe, you have something great to offer people through your products and services as a financial advisor? I really want to press him on get a yes, an unqualified yes. What that means is he knows he has a body of expertise and certain products that can help an individual to create the kind of financial future that on their own they couldn't do or wouldn't have to struggle to get to his level of what he could help this client with. And if Anthony can answer yes to that, an unqualified yes, then my third question to Anthony would be, if the answers to questions 1 and 2 is yes, then Anthony, why would you want to rob someone out of the opportunity to experience who you are and what you have to offer as a financial advisor?
That's good. All right.
And when Anthony starts coming to the right answer on that, I think he's going to realize being a financial advisor who goes out and meets people and attempts to sit down with them to help them create the financial future that they couldn't do on their own is not only something not to be ashamed of, but it's something to be proud of and to wear like a badge of honor. Then I think he's well on his way to becoming a success in his career.
Great. I love that. Okay, now, Jim, one of the reasons we've started this feature called Coach's Corner is because our surveys show that at least half of all advisors either have used a coach or are using a coach. It's clear the folks in this business, and let's acknowledge it can be a very solitary business for many, value the idea of getting professional coaching. I hear versions of the next question quite a lot, and it comes from Nick M. in San Francisco. Nick says, I've been with a coach for 5 years, and he is excellent, but doesn't work primarily with financial advisors. I've been researching other coaches for the last year and have interviewed 5 organizations, and I'm not happy with any of them for one reason or another. What's the best way to do further research and find the right coach for my needs? Jim, what's your advice for Nick?
Coaching for financial advisors is widespread. There are many different types of coaches, and there is, first of all, a science to it where you first define, here's exactly what I would like to accomplish in my business. So that's the place where Nick needs to start is, where do I want to get to? What area do I need coaching on? What area is my weakness that if I could overcome that weakness or that bottleneck, if you will, what would overcoming that lead to in terms of exploding my business, in terms of helping me go to the next level. And only when Nick has defined that should he begin the process of interviewing other coaches. And ideally, a good coach conducts a consultative interview of his own, in which is the place I begin with, asking Nick the question, well, first of all, give me some background on your business. How did you get started? Where did you study? Where did you get the degrees? How long have you been an advisor? And then the most important question is, tell me, what do you see as your biggest challenges or key areas of improvement you need to make to take your business to the next level? And then to take notes and listen carefully to his responses. And once I gather that information, I can determine if, in fact, even I'm the right coach for him or not, which sometimes I'm not. Now, fortunately, I know other coaches that have different specialties than me, so I do basically helping people on their ability to, first of all, create their focus, create their mission statement for their business, and then once they do that, to delegate, subcontract, and eliminate things that don't go along with them getting out there to meet with their clients, to ask for referrals effectively, to network with other professionals, and then to improve their professional selling skills. And if their challenges are something other than that, I know this isn't a good fit. So again, my advice to Nick is define what it is that he needs to do to explode his business to go to the next level. In other words, whatever his biggest challenges or key areas of improvement he needs to make, and only then go back and interview other coaches. And also, I'm wondering, well, if he identified these biggest challenges or key areas of improvement, could his existing coach,
right,
who he already says is excellent,
right, I know, yeah.
Well, and I don't think it matters so much if he's in the industry or not,
yeah,
if this coach says, yes, I can help you with those. But after 5 years, I'm suspecting that maybe they've identified that this coach can't.
Yeah, certainly when I read it, though, it did occur to me, it sounded like, wow, okay, well, you know, 5 years, he's excellent, he's interviewing all these other people, can't find anybody he's happy with. You wonder whether he's, you know, be sure to include the existing coach to give him, you know, in following your prescription, Jim. I would hope he'd also come back to his existing coach, don't you think, and at least, you know, give him a chance to respond to these issues,
what these things are
that he's hoping to improve on.
Again, there may be industry-specific challenges that Nick wants coaches on.
Yeah. Yep.
That both his existing coach doesn't handle, nor do I handle,
right,
and I know there are coaches out there that do handle them.
Mm-hmm.
So he needs to, hopefully he can go to some of his peers, either if he's in an organization or if he's independent, he can reach out to people he deals with and say, hey, here's my challenge, it's industry specific, who do you know, whether they're a coach or maybe it's a consulting firm, so it's not a coaching challenge.
Right.
To reach out to, and ideally he gets someone recommended to him, gets a reference saying, hey, this coach is great, or this advisory group is great, and you want to check with them and get an introduction.
Right. Good. Okay, Jim, thanks. We'll talk to you again soon. You've been listening to Jim Rohrbach, author of Horse's Mouth's Coach's Corner column. You can read it exclusively on Horse's Mouth. You can learn more about Jim and his coaching business by visiting him at his Success Skills website, which is www.successskills.com. My name is Sean Bailey, editor-in-chief at Horse's Mouth. Thanks for listening.
This Horse's Mouth presentation is offered specifically for financial advisors and may not be reproduced, broadcast, or distributed without permission from Horse's Mouth. Unauthorized use, reproduction, or distribution of this material is a violation of federal law and punishable by civil and criminal penalty.